Looks like everyone's here.
Today?
It looks like it, yes. Can people hear me all right? I'm using a new microphone, so let me know.
Yep.
Cool. And I also have my door open, but Bob, let me know if that's too much noise. All right. I will go around and say hello to everyone, starting with Ellen, Lori, and Joe, Franklin, Bob O, Diane, Phil, Linda, Deborah, Pat, Sam, Bob K, Vin, Amelia, Yeshe Tsoki, Sydney, Jim, Andy, Ruth Ann, Mary, Jessica, Jeannie, John, Bonnie, Marv, and I had to page to the next page, Amanda, Soon, Abdullah, Mark, W, and Cinda. All right, welcome everyone. And did I miss Bonnie? Oh, okay, good. It's difficult. So people rearrange on the screen sometimes. Okay. Let's see. In terms of announcements, you still have time to sign up for the term student program, which starts next Saturday with a half, essentially a half day retreat. So it'll start at 8:30. There'll still be the just sitting as usual if you just want to come for a sitting. But those of us who are doing the term student program will stick around and check in, share each other's life stories and our vows for the term. And there's information, if you don't know about it, on the website, Brightways End website, in the top, very top menu that you can say term student program. And it gives you guidelines for what you prepare for that first retreat and also how to formulate vows for the term. So there's ways to be skillful about vows, the kind of a clever way to say, I want to do this, but at least this, you know, I want to sit every day, but at least 5 days, or I want to sit 3 days a week, but at least one or whatever. And your vows can include anything, you know, zazen, reading, attending sangha stuff, usually some of that, but maybe just working with precepts or a particular precept or a relationship or some other aspect of your life, trying to be more mindful when you're at work, etc. So it can be very tailored to you and what you're working on. And then we do a closing retreat in December, similarly on a Saturday morning, check in about the term. And we do a couple email check-ins in the middle. And it's encouraged that you participate in one or both of the one-day retreats as well, but it's not required. And certainly there's also possibility of part-time participation in those retreats. Oh, so many cute dogs. let's see. And a picnic. Is Linda still here? Yes.
Morning. So the picnic, I don't have this in front of me. September 19th. This is a Saturday at Cedar Hills Park from 2 to 4. So come one, come all. Sadly, it's not a day I will be able to make it, but...
Oh, no! You helped organize, and now you can't come.
Maybe I can rearrange things, but we'll have masks, and we'll bring our own food, and we'll be social distancing. And it's a really lovely spot. It's where we held, where the Jukai was held, and it was just a really lovely spot. So hopefully.
Yeah. So just bring your own chairs, and, you know, I figure once we're sitting down, we can take our masks off once you're kind of, you know, stationary, like they do in restaurants. And you can certainly keep your mask on if you want, but one of the things I'm really noticing, I've been out and about interacting with people a little bit more lately, and it's just really weird to interact with people with masks on. It's really weird to have conversations and just like people can't see your expression. I ended up with somebody took a picture of me. I was downtown doing a demonstration last week, and I have this kind of rust colored mask, and I realized in the pictures it just looked like I didn't have a face. It just looked like I had no facial features. It was really weird. Let's see. I think that's it. Can anybody think of anything else that should be announced? All right. So I was going to talk today about how do you live a good life in a crazy world. And I don't know, I was trying to think of how to describe the aspiration, like a good life. I was thinking how to live a compassionate life, how to live a, I was trying to think of what I was getting at. Not even just moral. I was trying to think of what would be kind of the most widely appealing description for what I'm trying to talk about. And I kind of think that perhaps how to live a generous life, I think, is right what I'm leaning for right now. How to live a generous life in a crazy world. Kind of, because the idea is just how to, not just how do we maintain, how do we manage, how do we get through, but how do we go above and beyond even that, right? How do we extend beyond our own concerns, manifesting that in any way that we particularly aspire to do? So I have talked about this before, but I want to revisit and then just talk more about how this actually applies. But I suggest a recipe for practice, or even you might say a recipe for life, containing three ingredients. So bearing witness, taking action, and taking care. So these three things I'm proposing, all, ideally we have all three of them in our life and in our practice. And what I mean by ideal, I'll get to later, but essentially it's ideal for others as well as for ourselves. So in a really deep way, I'm talking about this is what I see as the ideal. So these three ingredients, bearing witness, means attending to and learning about the suffering of the world in all its forms, not excluding our own suffering, but opening up, bearing witness to the suffering of the world in all its different forms. And I'll get more into like why we do this, but essentially it's in order to make wise decisions, in order for us to be fully informed about the world and our choices, to activate our natural compassion. If we don't look, our compassion can't be aroused. Awaken a sense of urgency, perhaps, just to, but also, as I'll get to a little bit later, to see this bearing witness aspect of our practice as being of value in and of itself. So this is part of the Buddhist, Mahayana Buddhist teaching, which is embodied in the Bodhisattva Kanzeon, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And Kanzeon or Avalokiteshvara is portrayed as being ready to respond in many different ways and however is needed. But it's interesting that in the mythology and iconography surrounding Avalokiteshvara and Kanzeon, it's not primarily the response that matters so much. It's that he or she is always listening, always there, always bearing witness. You're not alone. Kanzeon is bearing witness. So this principle of compassion is about bearing witness to the suffering, being with others in the suffering. You know, and there's that definition of compassion, which is to suffer with, is to not be separate from other beings as they suffer. So we bear witness because Buddhist practice is based on seeing clearly. The truth is liberating. Delusion is like living in a dream. So that's got to be part of our practice. And this is often challenging, but I think it's helpful in our practice to see this as of value in and of itself, as an act of service, an act of generosity, apart from what we can do about what we see. So I think a lot of times as we're bearing witness, we get a sense of overwhelm or despair or uncomfortableness because we're like, oh, but I can't do anything about this anyway. Why would I just, you know, inform myself more about this stuff I can't do anything about? But I think it's possible to think of this as a practice separate from our response, which is part of why I've formulated this recipe for practice as including a taking action part. So then when we're bearing action, I mean, we're bearing witness, we're letting go of the taking action part for the time being. We're just listening. We're just learning. We're just absorbing. We're just being with. So then there is the taking action part, which I define as participating in a tangible way to help alleviate or prevent the suffering we witness. Some of it, anyway, right? And some of the suffering that we witness, and work for positive change in the world. So some kind of tangible way that we are trying to address suffering, decrease suffering, alleviate it, work for positive change. And then the third ingredient is taking care, engaging in activities, relationships, and practices that sustain us. So bearing witness can be exhausting. Taking action can be exhausting. The taking care is what we do to sustain ourselves. So we'll get into how that can look. So the idea is that the critical aspect of our practice is balance. That we try to include all three of these ingredients, but understand that the proportion of each ingredient in our life is going to vary over time, depending on our circumstances, our abilities, what's arising, our energy, the needs that we're facing. So just to explain a little bit, I don't imagine I need to, but just to put this in context, like why these aspects, particularly the bearing witness and taking action, I see as central to our practice, which is, of course, the Bodhisattva vow. So in Mahayana Buddhism, we aspire to something greater than our own salvation. But you might look at that as like, aren't we great and noble and generous because I'm not just going to look out for my own enlightenment. I'm going to take care of other people as well. So you can kind of see it as like in a dualistic way, and I'm being moral and generous. But at a more profound level, we see it as I can't be saved without everyone. Like that would just not really be possible. what kind of bodhisattva or Buddha would I be if I ditched all the suffering beings? I said, ah, well, I'm good now. I'm satisfied. I'm out of here. That, you know, then it's kind of an oxymoron then. Well, then you're not really a bodhisattva or a Buddha, right? If you're not in it with all beings. So in a way, we just see it as inseparable. My salvation is inseparable from the salvation of all beings. So we take our bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. So the Buddha way, we're as Mahayana Buddhists, we're aspiring to Buddhahood. Now, realistically, we know we're not going to get very far in this lifetime, but that's the direction we're going. That's what we aspire to. And a Buddha is not just an awakened being. A Buddha is a teacher. A Buddha is a skilled and dedicated guide for other beings. So that's part of the bodhisattva thing, right? Is that if we were to attain complete perfect enlightenment someday, we would want to help others with what we had achieved. We would want to share with others. And then our bodhisattva precepts include the three pure precepts. So cease from harm, release all self-attachment, do only good, take selfless action. And then the third pure precept is do good for others, embrace all things and conditions. Leap beyond the holy and the unholy. Let us rescue ourselves together with all beings. So if you have taken the precepts, you've promised to do this. So a little bit about that. The benefit to self and other are not two. So that the bodhisattva vow includes more than just taking care of ourselves. So that's that one aspect of our practice, taking care of ourselves physically, emotionally, spiritually, which is necessary. And, you know, who knows? Some people don't feel called to do much more than that in their life. And then kind of a measure of how, I don't know, your measure of your spiritual aspiration might be, how far do you extend that taking care, you know, beyond yourself or your immediate responsibilities? So I feel like the bodhisattva vow obviously asks us to extend our sphere of care as far as possible. So I've made two golden rules to keep your practice balanced and vital in the crazy world. Two principles to I'm trying to decide what metaphor to use for all of this. Are we cooking and these are ingredients? I thought about, are these threads and we're weaving a generous life? I don't know. It's kind of up to what appeals. But if we're cooking our life and we've got these ingredients, what are the two principles we would use? And the first is always be motivated by goodwill. I talked a little bit about that last week. No matter who, no matter what, for the sake of others as well as for the sake of ourselves, we strive. This is our goal. This is our ideal, is to always be motivated by goodwill. And then the second, to extend our sphere of care and responsibility as far as possible. And I feel like this is all about a direction and an ideal, right? I mean, if we could instantly become Buddhas, you know, we wouldn't have to practice. So this just is always this direction. And usually when we're feeling a little threatened or undernourished or whatever, you know, our sphere of care can get kind of small and we just kind of looking out for ourselves. Then, you know, we can take into consideration our family members and friends, then our community, then maybe our country, then maybe our sangha, maybe our country, all beings. Can we include non-human beings? Can we include all life? So we're always trying to extend that. And we do this, again, like I said, for the sake of others, but also for ourselves. So wanted to do a brief breakout to ask you, to have us ask us to reflect together. So common sense would say that we would benefit most if we primarily take care of ourselves. Just over the course of our lives, we would benefit most if we looked out for numero uno and those we're responsible for and those whose lives, you know, touch us directly, whether that's in terms of money, time, energy, attention, concern, whatever. That would be kind of the prevailing common sense. And that if you do something for others, you know, I mean, it comes at a cost. You're doing that because you want to be spiritual or, you know, a good person or whatever, but it comes at a cost. So I wanted us to reflect on, like, how do you personally benefit when you enact, when you're trying to fulfill the Bodhisattva vow, when you're enacting some aspect of your Bodhisattva practice, some aspect of your, you know, desire to be generous, to extend your sphere of care and responsibility, in what ways do you actually experience a benefit? And you can either think of it as, how do you personally benefit? Or if you prefer, you can think of it a little more kind of generally, abstractly. How do we personally benefit when we enact our Bodhisattva vows?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
And maybe this is what you want discussed in the small group. How are you defining benefit most?
I think that's pretty open. I think that's a good question to just throw out there. I don't know. Any thoughts? Any other questions?
It's very broad.
Yeah. I guess I could think of it as like anything that springs to mind. It could be, might actually be like material practical benefit, or it might be something more internal, more spiritual, if you will.
Okay.
All right. Meet for 10 minutes. Looks like everyone is back. So, moving on, how do we craft a good life, cook a good life, weave a good life out of these three ingredients? So I just thought of a few main areas of concern, main points. The first is that we need to skillfully and sustainably balance the three ingredients: bearing witness, taking care, taking action. Trying to include all three, but recognizing circumstances may change. And I think this is where mindfulness and self-awareness and honesty with ourselves really figures in. Asking ourselves at any given time, what is the state of these three ingredients in my practice? How am I bearing witness? How am I taking care? How am I taking action? How much of my life and energy is taken up in each of these? I know for myself, a lot of times I'm doing a lot of taking action and, you know, maybe not so much about the bearing witness, or maybe not enough taking care. The second thing is just noticing how this way of looking at things incorporates taking care of ourselves and our responsibilities, taking care puts it in the context of bodhisattva practice. So if you've kind of committed to having these three ingredients in your life, these three components, then taking care is not selfish. Taking care is part of the package and serves. So even if we are sitting on the couch eating chocolate while watching Netflix, you know, when these other aspects are in our lives, that is like totally cool bodhisattva practice, right? If it is something that is helping you relax and restore so that you can meet tomorrow, you know, great. So I found myself anyway in formulating it like this. I've been able to be more wholeheartedly present in those times, you know, when I'm just out gardening in my yard, I'm just hugging my dog, because it doesn't feel like I'm just, you know, sneaking this moment of joy despite the world's misery, or I'm not trying to, you know, cut out what's going in the world and just getting and or distracting myself. It's just like, now's the time for taking care. So that's a positive. And there's also the aspect that there's no denying that bearing witness and taking action are usually more challenging for us. So to include those aspects in our lives takes a little more effort. The taking care, I mean, it depends. Sometimes we don't take such good care of ourselves, but at least we know what we should do to take care of ourselves. The bearing witness and the taking action, it usually requires some energy, some time, stepping outside of our comfort zones, thinking creatively about the best way to approach things. Sometimes bearing witness can be upsetting, emotionally exhausting, discouraging, perhaps depressing. Taking action can be frustrating, not what we expected. We can run into all kinds of challenges there. So then, you know, then we balance those things with taking care. And I guess the last little point about the balance that I wanted to make was our practice and life is always our own responsibility. So we're not comparing ourselves to others. We're not feeling the need to defend our own practice. You know, we're not like, duh, Domino told me I needed to take more action. Shit, I only spend like, duh, I only do this and I probably should be doing more. And like, you know, I mean, there's a time and a place for teaching and sharing and discussing, but ultimately this is totally up to us. And if we're doing it, you know, because of anybody else's expectations, you know, it's not going to be very helpful. But we also want to be honest with ourselves about our own aspirations. And, you know, I mean, basically, I think, I don't know, I would imagine most of us, if we really stopped and said, okay, are we really fulfilling our own aspirations on a day-to-day basis? The answer would probably be like, not so much. So there's always room for that, right? So it's not so much a failing as just an admission that what we want to do in our lives is to constantly grow and learn and be honest with ourselves and challenge ourselves when necessary. So I did want to do an exercise of, I think one of the main challenges in terms of incorporating bearing witness and taking action into our lives can be because we don't know what to do. We don't know the how. Now, the taking care of ourselves, it's not always clear, but you know, for the most part, we know we're supposed to eat well, we're supposed to exercise, we're supposed to get enough sleep, maintain our relationships, you know, spend time with Sangha, do our Zazen, spend enough time doing relaxing and nourishing activities, you know, our hobbies and time in nature, entertainment, music, relaxation, reading for enjoyment, creative expression, if that's something that is a big part of your life. So, you know, we know if we're going to take care of ourselves, we probably know, like, all right, I should probably go do such and such. We may not be able to get ourselves to do it, but we kind of know what to do. But in terms of the bearing witness, that's a little, it's not quite as difficult, and then taking action. So what I wanted to do is pull up a blank document and then share my screen, and then we can do a brainstorm about bearing witness and what this can look like. So the question is, so bearing witness being attending to and learning about the suffering of the world in all its forms. So learning about it, just witnessing it, exposing ourselves to it. So let me share my blank document here. And so this is bearing witness. And go ahead and speak up if you have some ideas about the forms that this can take. Is that Ruth Ann?
Oh, yes, that's me. Are you ready to start your brainstorming?
I am.
Well, I think that it's good to call people our friends on if they made a statement that isn't as factual as it could be, or shedding a light on the wider picture. For an example, a friend told me how hard it is for her two kids, son and daughter-in-law, who teach at a middle school that have poor kids, ghetto kids, kids of immigrants, because they don't show up on Zoom for school lessons. And I told my friend that I knew from facts given from university professors, and I hear it on a lot of NPR reports, that so many what we call ghetto or poor areas of town have intermittent Wi-Fi, and that kids have to go sit in the parking lots of fast food so that they can draw that Wi-Fi so they can do their homework. And she said, this friend is intelligent, but lived a professional life for years as an instructor in a medical college, but she had not heard that, and she wasn't hearing that from her kids, who are teachers trying to do their best. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times, I think immigrant parents don't show up for things because they're not sure how to approach some of, you know, the questions that are more standardized. So it's seeing, I think, calling any of us. I hope to be called on when I state something that isn't correct.
Ruth Ann, I love that. I mean, in the way that I'm formulating it, I would almost call that more like taking action. I mean, I think because it's, or you are aware of it because you bore witness, right? You learned about the situation. Yeah. And then the speaking up to the friend is actually like doing something tangible in the world to hopefully help. So I guess I see that as taking both parts. So thank you.
Yeah, well, we've been friends since the 70s, so you know, but I do think that, you know, it's called, we called it the hospital, the teachable moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ruth Ann, may I actually accept your invitation to make a comment on something hurtful, if that's okay?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. This is not surprising since language shifts over time, but generally referring to people as ghetto when they're in fact, you know, disadvantaged can be really hurtful. That makes sense that you might not have known that given how language shifts over
time. Well, as soon as it came out of my mouth, I thought, oh, I read Jonathan Cozzell. I know better. But I just don't want to be taking up other people's speaking time. But thank you.
That is kind of you. Thank you for being considerate of that. Thank you.
All right. Bearing witness. How else do we bear witness?
It's maybe a little bit off, but I want to say journaling because quite often things are already in your head and they're already in your heart and you're already responding in some way that you're not paying attention to. And noting it formally that way can make it more real.
I like that because we're bearing witness not just to what's outside, but also to what's within.
I have really appreciated and respected
Your audio just went off, Amanda. I don't know why. You're not on, it doesn't look like you're on mute. I can't hear you. Your audio just went off.
Yeah, we can't hear you.
Oh. I'm going to throw reading the news in on the bearing witness.
You know, I go straight from the reading the news to the taking care of myself part. I have to. You know, in our little breakout group, we were talking a lot about just listening to another person, deeply listening. And sometimes that's the action. Sometimes that's it. It's just to acknowledge that we're listening and that we've heard them. Because sometimes people don't want you to take action. You know, they just want to know that people are hearing them. Mm-hmm. And that maybe that they care, you know.
Oh, no, we still can't hear Amanda.
So I think I fixed it.
Okay, there you go.
Thank you for your patience. The practice in social justice circles to literally say out loud the names of people murdered by law enforcement is an action, but it's like a ritual of bearing to that pain and loss, which we do here, even outside of that movement, saying the names of those who are in the transition of death.
Sweet. Other thoughts?
For taking action?
No, for bearing witness. We're still in.
Oh, I got that. I was adding a new item.
Ah, cool. I'm sorry. Yes.
For taking action, I would say to the extent possible or sustainable, giving of yourself either money or time or attention to try to work to resolve the problems that you're witnessing.
Yeah. Many different ways to give of yourself. And the, I guess to just to finish up our bearing witness list, I was also thinking of, there's many different forms that this can take, books, movies, documentaries, that, you know, they inform, whether they're fictional or non-fictional, they broaden your mind and they inform you about history, or they inform you about the experiences of others, you know, past or current suffering or injustices. Also thought about travel, depending on what you do when you travel. If you just stick in the posh tourist sites, perhaps not so much. But if you travel and you really expose yourself to the full range of life in each place you go, as well as like service work in our own community. Suffering and injustice in our own community, like, you know, going to the food bank, or you know, working with the homeless, or working with people with addictions or something. I mean, there's and in a way, obviously, those are also taking action. So, you know, a lot of times these things overlap, but in the process of doing that activity, you expose yourself in a completely different new way to what's going on. So, yeah, go ahead.
Just really quickly, when you were talking about books, movies, and documentaries, I also thought of just going to visit museums and seeing mm-hmm. art in itself, because like you were saying, like that fictional aspect, it gives you an inside view into how someone else sees the world, and that, you know, going to art by, you know, exhibits that are put on by African Americans, or, you know, even ancient art from around the world can mm-hmm. just really open up that different view for individuals. So,
And
yeah, it doesn't have to be painful. It can be enlightening and mm-hmm. beautiful too, I think. So,
good point. Good point.
Just to kind of piggyback on your travel comment, Domio, that all of the travel I've done in Asia has been for work. And while we may be staying in what could be considered a tourist, could be nicer part of town, those areas aren't very large. And my travel, I've done a lot of travel out to factories through outside the cities, through the country, and it's amazing. So hand in hand with that is photography.
Ooh.
I have a lot of photos just out of the vans, traveling from the hotel I'm staying to the, going out to the factories and through, because they're not in, the factories aren't in the city. They can't afford that land. They're actually outside the cities, and I'm usually traveling 1 to 2 hours.
Wow.
And it's amazing once you get out of the hotel zone, mm-hmm. you know, the tourist hotel zones of the cities of like Ho Chi Minh City and Bangkok and stuff. What's just outside the cities and the infrastructure outside of Western culture.
Thank you.
Can I add something to the bearing witness? I know you're trying to move on.
Yeah.
Since the pandemic started, I've turned more towards the Brahma Viharas from the early Buddhist tradition. And a friend taught me metta meditation a long time ago, but I added the compassion meditation to that, and just, you know, bearing witness in meditation to the fact that we're all subject to danger and illness and discomfort and so on. And I thought of this when you were talking about extending our care out of our immediate sphere of friends and self to, you know, neutral people, difficult people, and potentially any being that could suffer. So that's been new to me in the past 6 months, but really beautiful.
That's a good point. We have actual practices of doing that, right? Actual practices for expanding your sense of care and concern. So it's 12:13. So taking action as usual is going to total get short shrift. But you know, perhaps we can revisit that, because I think that area in particular is one where I think it's very common for us to go, yeah, I should be taking more action, but you know, what could I do? What is there to do that is going to make any difference, or, you know, that I could fit into my life, or that wouldn't just be end up being kind of frustrating or whatever. So, you know, it takes some creativity. I think there's lots and lots of ways for us to show up subtle and very, more obvious. Obviously, just treating people with kindness and trying not to do harm is a way of taking action. Working within our political system, trying to preserve our democracy, you know, educating children, you know, there's many different ways that we can be of service. But I will just close with suggesting that this recipe for practice is a useful thing to turn to when we are feeling cognitive dissonance. So I'm suggesting it as a cure for cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance being when we're aware at some level that our behavior is not matching our beliefs. It's not, how we're acting is not matching our understanding of the world, our aspirations, our values, and there a tension and a stress happens within us. And it's almost impossible, I believe, in this modern life to live without a significant amount of cognitive dissonance, because we're all so interdependent in this system of destruction and injustice that and we don't like it, and yet we're involved in it and culpable, and I think this is something that we live with to some extent. But I think this particular recipe can do a lot for cognitive dissonance, whether, like I said earlier, it's that kind of recognizing that taking care can be in service, that if we're committed to having these other aspects of our life, that we don't have to experience as much cognitive dissonance when we're just taking care. We can recognize when we're bearing witness and we're thinking like, why am I doing this? There's nothing I can do. This is depressing. This is overwhelming. Blah, blah, blah. If we can see it as a service, as generosity, as a practice in and of itself, you know, there's some dignity and willingness there. And then we can feel, okay, I'm going to do a little bit, like So-On said, I'm going to do a little bit of that. Now I'm going to do some taking care, you know, that understanding it needs to be balanced. And then, like I said, it's mostly taking more action that is very challenging, because it involves sacrifice. It requires to think outside the box and explore new territory. So just going to leave you with three ways to increase the proportion of the taking action ingredient in your life. And then we can talk about it some more sometime. So One, just devote more time and energy to it. So when you look and you say, okay, here's, I want it to be a larger proportion, but that, you know, just like all of our goals and practice, it doesn't have to be, now I'm going to become a full-time activist, right? You can be like, I'm going to try to spend 2 hours a week or something like that, right? Some kind of doable increase, and then have the action, whatever the action is, involve more of yourself. So, you know, many of us try to give money to causes we believe in, or we, you know, maybe we do some reading and educate ourselves, or, but kind of the more we can get involved, the more we can interact with other people, the more it involves body, speech, mind, relationships, our passions, our skills, the more this aspect of our lives, kind of become, takes a life of its own, takes on some more energy. And then just the third thing is approaching whatever action that we do with the attitude of what Joanna Macy calls active hope. So picking something that we think is halfway decent, halfway beneficial, like just our best bet, something we can do, and then just doing it and letting go of the results. I mean, to some extent, every once in a while, maybe you evaluate and say, is this still worth doing? But for the most part, you just say, this is what I'm going to do. Well, the taking action I am going to do is this thing, this one little piece. and then what she says is you're focused not on what you hope will happen, but you are enacting what you hope for in the world. So it is about your practice. You've chosen this particular action, and then you know that that aspect of your practice is represented. And I recommend that's a good recipe. So, all right, so we're 4 minutes over. Sorry. You're welcome to say goodbye and log off. If anybody has any final comments, you're welcome to chime in.
Danya?
Yeah.
You said before you had to shift screens. If you go over to the upper left-hand side of your screen, there's a little shield with a green shield with a check mark.
Oh!
If you click on that,
uh-huh.
That's your settings. If you go to video,
yeah,
and then down in meetings, there is a checkbox saying display up to 49 participants per screen in gallery view.
Ooh. Cool. Ordinarily, I'm on my laptop and that doesn't work so well, but now I'm on my big screen, so I think I can see everybody.
Yep.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right, everybody. Have a lovely day.
Have a lovely day.
Are you going to do your dedication at the
end? Oh, thank you for the reminder, Pat. Sitting up here at my desk, so I forgot. I'll go get my bell. All right. Yeah, abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Bob. I mean, Bob K, my tech guy. Do you think, how is the audio?
Better.
So this was, I'm on my main computer, so I was able to use my, the lapel mic.
Yep.
And then let me switch to my, okay, so now the microphone is in my webcam.
Not good.
Yeah. So this is the lapel mic helps a lot, huh?
A lot. Yes.
Cool.
It's broader bandwidth and not so rumbly. Yeah, go back to your lapel mic.
All right, so now I'm back on the lapel mic.
I did notice one thing. When you talk to your left, the lapel mic came up probably twice the volume to where you were talking over to your right side.
Hmm. It so like
dropped off.
Just like turning this much or?
Yeah, it was noticeable.
Huh.
So I'm wondering how.
Can I bring it and I bring it up closer? And then I don't know, does it make it that much of a difference when I turn my head and talk in different directions?
It's a different tonality, but it's just different. I'm not saying it's worse, but it's the lapel mic is a lot better than the mic in your camera.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, I'm improving my Zoom tech because, you know, here we are. We might as well.
Well, you and I need to have a discussion about a couple of other things at some other time.
Okay.
So do you want me to set up a meeting with you through your system or?
Sure.
How do you want to do that?
Sure.
Okay.
And then I think one of them is that you can say it's a business meeting instead of a Dharma interview. So not, okay. I mean, I'll know, but.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Romeo, wait.
Yeah.
Have you any knowledge of Paulette Sacco?
Paula, did you say?
Paulette.
Paulette. Oh, you mean the woman who shows up sometimes?
Yeah, she was very regular.
Uh-huh.
And haven't seen her for quite a while.
I think I just saw her like last Sunday.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
Okay. I guess I need to show up more.
You show up pretty often, but she might have just been.
I thought so.
You might have been on another part of your screen or something, and you're just on a phone, right? You can only see like four people.
I'm just on a phone, and it's a small phone.
You gotta get yourself a tablet at least. I mean, then you can see like nine people.
Oh no. Okay, thank you.
All right.